downside to recording 32 bits float, so why not do it? Well, the answer is, knowing the few basic rules, about 24 bits or even 16 bits recording saves you a lot of work in post-production, and that's what Dr. Roy was kind enough to mention. Setting the gain on 24 bits recorded is hard, some people say, and the audio clips cannot be fixed in the post. Well, the marketing around 32-bit float recording seems to be focused on and what a lot of people are kind of talking about and thinking about. If you are recording dialogue and you are using 24-bit, that good quality $400 recorder with good preamplifier and good converter would work, and you don't have to spend the money for it. Any comment? And to exchange.
Again, these are straw man arguments. I don't know any rational person who would come up with any of those questions. They're the fundamental reasons why people buy 32 float audio is so that if they made a mistake and they set the levels too high and they distorted the audio, the only actual way to recover it is with something like a 32 float. That's it. It's not that it sounds better. It's not that it's better or feels better. It's just that ability to error correct if you made a terrible mistake. The place where the audio files go crazy with each other is not the number of bits. It's the rate per second. You know, some people think that they need, you know, 380,000 bits per second streaming through their DACs when, you know, you can't even hear 20 hertz. So that's where the arguments go about fidelity, not with the bit steps, but with the bit rate.
Yeah, I can agree with that. If you go to the formula explaining 32-bit floating, we would say that it is a floating point representation internally for all audio data. So floating point means that it can basically represent very loud sounds and very quiet sounds with the same fidelity resolution, with a fixed point representation like CD audio. Very quiet sound has much worse resolution. So, yes, for the idiot-proof operator, you're absolutely right. And to exchange.
Okay, I mean, there are people who want that extra insurance. I mean, when I do the TechNet, I send a lot of times a copy over to Mike over at amateurradio.tv, and I must have three or four copies of this net being recorded simultaneously. Two or three on the computer, one on the radio, all over the darn place. So, you know, some people like that kind of redundancy. They want to be sure something is going to work.
Absolutely, absolutely. Even professionals, I agree with you, even professionals use two or three recorders or a recorder with the two tracks on it in different formats just to make sure that they didn't lose the case. And to exchange.
Yeah, and 32 float was a novel addition, maybe 8-9 years ago, to the commercial, individual owners, you know, guys like us. But nowadays, pretty much every manufacturer of any wireless system, Rode, DJI, and a bunch of other companies, all feature 32-bit recordings. It's the recordings that are important because you're going to if you're going to get yourself out of trouble, you got to take the recording and manipulate the recording. The audio output of all these devices output to 16 or 24 bits, again, because your ear would go crazy with the dynamic range of 32 bits. The sound decibel at its peak would be enough to kind of blow the roof off of your house.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're right. The next one, history file is important to American citizens trying to understand his and her tomorrow. Here I would like to talk about history, not politics, as knowledge of the history of USA and recent threats events in the EU is even more essential to every American tomorrow than ham radio space events, as it is impacting the average American life, safety, and budget today. Okay, on 24 February was the third year of aggression in Ukraine affecting the economies of EU and USA. From February 2024 to February 2025, which is only 1 year, aggressor force moved approximately 300 feet in average, losing approximately 430,000 of troops, not including wounded. Alcohol is one of the tools in their front line. In Ukraine, average Russian in age of 45 to 49 drinks around one European size of one glass of pure vodka per day. That comes to 1 liter of vodka per week. Every fifth adult Russian dies from it. And just to give you better perspective, you need to know that Russian, in average, drinks 1,500 shots per year. 1,500 shots per year. But if we say that we have a population of 146 million in Russia, and we cut that in half because half of it is the population of men, not of the woman, and then we cut it on two. Actually, we should cut it into the four parts of the other families and the two children. That's one fourth of the 146 million drinks. 1,500 shots per year times four. I'm not saying about the nation of alcoholics, but I'm saying about the history file was going on. Let me try. Okay. So the next one I don't hear the receiver. Okay. The government mentioned that Russian government that they have nuclear weapons. And they could use it against us, and that was done 20 times, and 468 times in the past year was repeated by propaganda. So Russia has 110 deployed nuclear warheads, and 12 ballistic missile submarines with 192 submarine launch ballistic missiles. And a Russian missile uses six warheads without the one that was launched on Ukraine without the nuclear material on it had six warheads, and it was presented to us as what it is to us. Okay. The next one is Skype will shut down at May 1st of this year. So anybody who uses Skype and has contacts, it is good if you find another platform, back up your contacts so you do not have to lose your contacts. Thank you, John. And I need Dr. Roy, because we have a subject, can the electric field exist without magnetic field, and can magnetic field exist without electric field, Dr. Roy?
AC2GS. Well, the answer is very short, no.
How about the magnet?
No. Magnetism and electrical charge are quantum mechanical aspects. They're fundamental force in the photon. They exist out of relativity. Where there's an electric field, there's a magnetic field. Where there's a magnetic field, there's an electric field. It's just a matter of kind of reorienting yourself to a different reference frame. And as Einstein said, there is no primary reference frame. You can decide on a reference frame. Any one that you want is just as legitimate as every other. So in some reference frames, it might appear that it's a magnetic field. In others, it might appear that it's electric field, but because you're not locked into a reference frame, fundamentally, magnetism and electrical charge are two sides of the same coin.
Dr. Rick, when can I catch you on something? Because I'm trying very hard, and you are kind of uncatchable. Anyhow, if we go to the atoms, we may say, do atoms have a magnetic field? And the answer to this question is yes. But we're talking about a charge. Charge has electric field. Has a charge. Charge is a point, has a charge. But when it moves, then we have a ball. But at the same time, we have electrons which are charges, and they are moving. So as they have a speed, so when it appears that we have a magnetic field only, we actually talking about the spin of electrons in different direction, and they cancel each other. Mr. Roy.
Well, again, it's a matter of frame of reference. Say you have a charged metal ball in your laboratory, and it's sitting there stationary. So you're saying to yourself, world, this is solely an electrical charge. There's no magnetism. There's no reason to be magnetic. I will tell you, well, that's the problem with your frame of reference. Let's change the frame of reference from where you're standing to outer space and assume that you have a very, very good receiver that can pick up any fluctuations of electromagnetism. You will detect electromagnetism out of your stationary static charge globe, even though it's stationary in your frame of reference. As far as some guy floating in outer space, you're on a planet that's both rotating around, spinning, and then rotating around the sun. And then the sun is rotating around the galaxy. So there's a lot of motion, which is producing some degree of magnetism and electromagnetism. So it's the frame of reference that depends on these things.
I'm going to try to be more accurate, I mean, more into the description. All electrons do produce magnetic fields as they spin and orbit the nucleus. However, in some atoms, two electrons spinning and orbiting in opposite direction pair up, and the net magnetic moment of the atom is zero. The direction of the spin and orbit of the electron determines the direction of the magnetic field. And electron pairing occurs commonly in the atoms of most materials. In the experiment I don't remember who was the first guy, so I'm gonna skip it. But I'm gonna ask a question, Dr. Roy. Do all atoms have magnetic fields?
They all have a charge. Matter of fact, a neutron itself, just a neutron, has a magnetic dipole moment.
Well, in general, all materials, materials, not all, they have a paired electrons in their atoms, and they have no net magnetic moment. We actually call those materials diamagnetic. But there are some exceptions. When placed in the magnetic field of the magnet, diamagnetic material will produce a slight magnetic field that opposes the magnetic field. Both ends of bar magnet will repel a diamagnetic material if the diamagnetic material is placed in the strong external magnetic field. The magnetic field strength inside the material will be less than the magnetic strength in the air surrounding material. So the slight decrease in the field strength is the result of realignment in the orbit motion of the electrons. The diamagnetic materials could be zinc, gold, mercury, bismuth. I don't recall more, but there are plenty more, Dr.
There's all kinds of different magnetism, paramagnetism, ferromagnetism. I won't go on and on, because it would go on and on. And besides, I didn't even bring up electrons. I'm talking about a neutron. A single neutron has a magnetic dipole moment. It has no electrons in them.
Yeah, but the primary question was, could we see the material that has a magnetic field that cancels itself because of the spin of the electrons as the zero magnetic field? In other words, I'm trying to somehow catch you, which is almost impossible. Your statement that you say no, all materials must have electric field must exist with the magnetic field.
Yes, they do. If you're talking about magnitude of magnetic field density, and so, unpaired electrons do have the ability to have more. But any charged particle which includes an electron, even if it's paired, two electrons do not neutralize their electric charge. And as long as those two have an electric charge, there's some aspect in adjusting the frame of reference where you will discover a magnetic field as well. It's just not in the frame of reference that you're standing in front of the lab. But Einstein said that frame of reference has no priority. You can pick any frame of reference in the universe, and under those circumstances, you will provoke a magnetic field.
Well, talking about unpaired electrons, most of the materials with one or more unpaired electrons are at least slightly magnetic. materials with the small attraction to the magnet, those are paramagnetic materials, and those with the strong attraction called ferromagnetic materials. So aluminum, platinum, manganese, and some paramagnetic materials. Iron, cobalt, and nickel are examples of ferromagnetic materials, and paramagnetic and ferromagnetic materials have a significant difference in the spin of electrons.
Again, you're kind of telling me 18th century magnetism, which was great in the 18th century. Unfortunately, this is the 21st, and we do have relativity. And I'm citing relativity, and you're going back to 1835 and such, which, you know, you're free to do, but it doesn't get us anywhere. There is an inherent, the reason why one of the fundamental forces is not electrical charge or magnetism. The reason is because it's electromagnetism, because the two concepts are just two different sides of the same coin. And, you know, I'm sorry if you want to go back to 1800s when guys didn't have the faintest idea about quantum mechanics or relativity. But that's what's going on. You kind of, I'm talking about apples and you're talking about fried watermelons or something. I don't know. Something completely different. So I don't know what to tell you. I'm just telling the Newtonian physics of the 1800s was a very nice approximation for how things work. The devil is in the details, and part of the devil's details is relativity.
Absolutely agree with you, that's right. Yeah, I was trying, but not with you. It doesn't work with you. And to Xia.
Okay, well, I gave you the opportunity to try. What can I tell you? It's sort of fascinating, and you'll get some kind of yelling and screaming on the very minute details of how relativity explains the idea of magnetism and electricity. There's some jerky guy who sounds a lot like just an unfortunate, sad little high school science teacher who has a couple of YouTubes out there where he takes magnetism, he changes the frame of reference, and shows that it seems to act like an electric field, and he says, therefore, there is no magnetism, it's all electricity. So all this is nonsense. What he doesn't do is show that he could take an electrical field, change the frame of reference, and have it turn into a magnetic field, and use the same excuse that there's no electrical fields either.
Absolutely. I mean, the trip to the past was, when in physics we were told at first that when you're talking to somebody trying to take the opposite side, it doesn't matter if you are successful or not. It is that the discussion is interesting because you can reveal the other party level in that particular subject. So yes, you're supposed to be psychologist and direction.
Okay, I mean, I'm more than happy to discuss things like general relativity and such. I assume there's a few people vaguely interested. I assume there's somewhat more that are kind of scratching their head and say, what the hell does this have to do with anything? So, you know, for those people, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, for people interested, I hope you enjoyed yourself. So, Wes, I think you've gotten to the end of your list. I know 1026, so I think we should kind of move on.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. Thank you very much, the audience, and to Eugene Stevens.
Okay, thank you, Wesley, as always, for your participation and what you do for the technical net. Now it is time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2N.
ACQGSWS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Very good, guys. We have one breaking news story I would like to talk about, and that would be the landing of an American company's spacecraft onto the moon, which happened last night at 3:30 roughly in the morning. The name of the spacecraft is Blue Ghost. Blue Ghost was built by a company named Firefly Rocket Company. And they launched, it was January 15th. It took 45 days for it to leave Earth, orbited the Earth a few times, and eventually orbited the moon a few times. And it did successfully land on the moon. If you look at the moon, it's the northeast quadrant. So you look up, and if you look straight up, you're right. It's a big round area, and that's where the where it's sitting right now. It's called Mare Crisium, and that circles a little over 300 miles in diameter. So yeah, very successful. It's got, you know, four legs on it. Before I go any further, it did send its first picture back earlier this morning. So I downloaded that picture and I sent it over to Dr. Roy's website. So if you go to roy.ac2gs.com, you'll see all of Roy's stories, but scroll down a little bit, you'll see the picture. What they did was, after they landed, they had a camera look at the Earth, taking a picture. But sure enough, the sun is behind the camera, so it created a shadow on the moon, and you can see the shadow of the lander and the legs sitting there. There's going to be a lot of pictures that are going to come back to this. This is through the S-band antenna. The X-band antenna was not deployed yet. I think a couple of hours before that actually gets deployed. But once that's up and running, they'll be able to not only send pictures back, but high-def video, which is going to be very, very interesting. Let me drop it. The second American company to actually land on the moon. You had one last year, but you might remember that one kind of like tilted over. That was by Intuitive Machines. I mean, they got a lot of data back and all. They considered it a success, but this one landed, you know, four legs down, and they didn't have the kinds of problems. It does have terrific software on board where, you know, it's got cameras and LIDAR and all, and as it's going across the surface, if it detects a problem, a big boulder or something like that, it will move to a different location, which it did. It actually picked up some problem twice before it landed, so it moved out of the way and came down successfully. It has a total of like nine rockets. There's eight reaction control thrusters and then one main thruster in the beginning, right in the middle of it. You know, each small thruster is a couple hundred newtons. They all came out at the same time. You got to remember, it's in orbit around the moon, getting lower, you know, as the days went on. So, for its final deorbit burn, all the engines had to come on for 9 minutes, and then they shut off. And according to the news conference I heard, everything went perfectly. I mean, they didn't have to make any adjustments. There weren't any cases where rocket engines stayed on too long or too short, where they had to compensate with different maneuvers. I mean, it went by the book all the way down to landing. So it should be interesting. They have 10 different science experiments on board the lander. Deep Blue is, Blue Ghost has 10 different experiments, and they're all like by NASA. The NASA was heavily involved with this, so they covered the landing as well. As well as Firefly and all. I didn't get a chance to review the, I didn't stay up for it, but I reviewed the landing and all. So, some of the experiments, they have a vacuum on board where it's going to be lowered to the surface. It's going to blow nitrogen through the exterior of it. It's going to force regular, moon dirt into the unit, and then from there we'll analyze it. So they wanted to test that. Instead of using a scoop, they're using this vacuum method. So they're going to try that. One of the things that apparently was successful is the GPS system. They're able to copy the GPS, our GPS satellites, all the way to the moon. And they're using that for navigation. That wasn't the primary, that was the secondary, but it turns out in the future they might be able to, they'll probably use it, as a primary for navigating. But that worked out, they said, very good. They're picking up not only our GPS system, they're also picking up the Galilean GPS system. Galilean is a European version of our GPS. They have a whole bunch of satellites up there. So they're able to use both. One of the experiments that they have on board is this long drill. It's going to drill like a couple of meters into the ground with a probe on the end to analyze what's under the moon. That I'm looking forward to. One of the experiments, I talked about this probably last week or the week before. They plan on getting dust onto this one area from the moon, and when they click this grid pattern, all the dust will move off the surface. So in the future, if this works out, they'll be able to use it to get dirt away from certain things. You don't want to have living quarters on the moon and bring this regolith in. It's very dangerous. If you get it into your lungs, you inhale it, it's like worse than fiberglass. So that's going to be an interesting experiment. And then they have a couple of other things. They have a reflector system. A lot of landers now, they have these corner reflector systems where, future spacecraft will be able to send a light down, like a laser light down, and depending on the time it takes to hit it, it comes back. If it's retro reflector, always, wherever you transmit the light from, it will come back exactly where it was transmitted from. So they'll be able to use that for navigation as well. So that's on board. And a few other experiments, that's not 10 of them, but that's most of them. So we're looking forward for the next 2 weeks. They landed right in the beginning of the lunar day. Lunar day takes 14 Earth days. They plan on doing these experiments 14 solid days. And when they get to the end of the 14 days, they will be able to work into the night. Roughly about 5 hours is the time that they said they'll be able to work. Because, it's solar-powered batteries will be charged. But once it gets into nighttime, 14 days from now, no more sun, So they'll just use battery power until it quits, and they're going to use that power to power all the experiments, you know, right up until the end. Any comments about Blue Ghost?
This is Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform 4. How are you?
Yeah, good, Charlie. So as you can tell, this was the main topic for tonight, that's for sure. You know, did you have any questions or comments?
Yes. This Blue Ghost, will it, if we make a landing on the moon, can we plug the Blue Ghost into a lunar module or a car and recharge the car? Can this create power for what may be needed on the moon?
No, it's not designed for that. You know, this is a first shot by Firefly to do this. They have two others that are in development now, and they're going to be a little bit more advanced. Each one, you know, will be able to do better things. But, you know, in the future, you know, you're going to have larger vehicles from different companies, and some of those will have, you know, different ways of creating power that they'll be able to use for astronauts when they land, you know. Jeff Bezos' company, Blue Origin, eventually will have a fuel cell system to create electricity on the moon, you know, as well as solar power as well, you know. But there'll be more advanced systems. They plan on sending up 10-kilowatt fission nuclear systems to, you know, create power in the future. So, you know, this is the first step by Firefly. Their next flight will be later this year. They plan on landing on the far side of the moon. But to do that, they're going to need satellite, you know, in orbit around the moon that they're going to use to transmit back to Earth. So, you know, once it's on the far side, we won't get any signals directly from Blue Ghost 2. But what they will do is they'll send the signal to that satellite, and that satellite will transmit information back to Earth. So that, you know, that's one of the advances that they're going to do. And then the third one is being planned. I'm not sure where that thing is going to land. And then, depending how things go and whether they get financed by NASA, they plan on future landers as well. You know, each one, you know, bigger and better than before. Back to you, Charlie.
That was my main concern, you know, does it produce power, you know, as needed? But apparently it doesn't. Okay.
It's a good size vehicle. I mean, it stands about, I don't know, it looks like about 7 feet tall, maybe about 7 or 8 feet wide. So, you know, I think it's quite heavy. You know, it worked out good, you know. I'm glad to see that they made it. There's another one on its way. It was launched a couple of days ago. It's called the Nova C. It was launched Wednesday, February 26th. It's called Athena. And the type of vehicle is called Nova C. That one's by Intuitive Machines. So Blue Ghost took 45 days to land because of the system that they used to get there. This thing it's more of a direct shot. Launched on Wednesday, and it will land. It plans on landing March 6th, which is this coming Thursday. So it's only, you know, half a day, well, it's about six or seven days to get there. So that's a big difference. Now, two of the machines building this Nova C lander that they're calling Athena should land around 12 noon on that day. So if you're home, you'll be able to, like I am, I'm retired, I'll be able to tune in live, hopefully, and watch this thing. This one's got six legs. Lugos has four, this one has six. This one is taller. This one's like about 8 feet, 8.5 feet tall. You might remember last year, the same company, Intuitive Machines, landed one, but it kind of like tilted over on a 30-degree angle. And they had trouble with reception and all, but they did get, you know, a lot of information back. So that, they consider that a success. This one, I mean, Blue Ghost is definitely a success. I mean, it landed with all four legs up. So now Intuitive Machines, the one that had the one that tilted over, has now another one on its way right now, and that will land on Thursday. I'd like to see how that one works out. That one's going to land on the South Pole, which is an interesting location because that is the future landing site of astronauts. You know, they plan on doing a lot of the work in the future, moon base and all that will be on the South Shore, the South Pole. So we'll see how Nova C Athena does. And I think they're going to make it because the last one made it, but they had a little trouble with the, as it came down, it had too much forward movement. They think when it hit, the one leg hit first as it was moving forward and crumpled the leg and the vehicle wound up on a tilt. Anyway, when Intuitive Machines was launched by SpaceX last week, it had also two satellites that would be heading to the moon that they were planning on using. One was called Trailblazer, and the other one was called Odin. And like, for instance, Odin's like this 500-pound thing that's separated from the second stage, just like Intuitive Machines did. But Odin is, right now, they said, out of control as of yesterday. They do not want to know what happened to it. They're trying to bring it back to life. It's in a spinning type of motion. And that was supposed to go out near the moon. It was supposed to look, orbit the moon and look down and look for areas where you might have frozen ice and all. But I have a funny feeling that one's out of order. I hope they regain control of Odin and Trailblazer. Didn't look good from, last time I just read something about it from that company. Any comments? Coming up very shortly on late at night from the 13th to the 14th, from like 11:30 or so at night into 6 o'clock in the morning the next day on the 14th. Now, did I say solar eclipse? Wrong. It's a lunar eclipse for us. If you were on the moon, it would be a solar eclipse. So it's a lunar eclipse, so we'll be able to, if it's a clear night, go out and look to, you know, watch the shadow of the Earth going from the front of the moon, this would will be able to be seen, you know, across the United States. So looking forward to that. And since the Blue Ghost will be sitting on the moon when this occurs on the 14th, the scientists have plans on using their cameras to look back at Earth. So that's why if you're on the moon, it's like a solar eclipse. They're going to see the Earth with the sun behind it. Yeah. You know, so that's going to be an interesting picture by Blue Ghost. And with they have super-duper cameras on board Blue Ghost. So looking forward to see what the Earth looks like from the moon. It will actually be a solar eclipse. Of course, on Earth, we look back at the moon, and at the exact same time, it will be a lunar eclipse. That should be interesting. That's a very, very good system that they'll have with their cameras. They have high-definition cameras. They're also going to use the leg cameras. On each leg, they had cameras. They called them stereo something or other cameras. And the reason for those was they would like to see what's happening with all the dust and material that gets blown off from the moon as the spacecraft came down. And, you know, they record that in high definition, and sometime during the next couple of days they'll be sending that video back to Earth. But they plan on also using those cameras to supplement the other cameras that will be looking at the horizon, first they'll be using the cameras for the solar eclipse of Earth, but as the day on the moon comes to an end, which is 14 days, and transitioning to night, they plan on using the cameras to look at the horizon, and they want to see what they call dust levitating off the surface of the moon. This was reported many years ago during one of the Apollo missions. They claim they saw this like levitational action occurring when it was getting very dark. I believe it was Apollo 17 with Cernan. Harris on board. So we'll see. They're looking to duplicate that scenario, and they're going to try to figure out what the science is behind the levitation of dust coming off the moon during sunset. And that'll be done with the Blue Ghost system. Now, with the Intuitive Machines, when that lands, that does have a small little rover built by. UAE, United Arab Emirates, built a small little rover that's attached to the Intuitive Machine one. So if that thing lands successfully, eventually the rover will drive away. Rover also has on it this little tiny red, looks like a red house. You know, it's considered artwork. I talked about this, I think, last week. And they plan on bringing this little red house out and putting it down a certain distance away from the lander, but between the lander and Earth. So the cameras will take a picture of this little red house, very colorful red house, sitting on this bland-looking moon with the Earth in the background. So, somebody got this bright idea to do this years ago, and that's what they plan on doing. It's one of the interesting side notes. It's really not scientific, but I guess artistic, or, you know, I'm not sure what it qualifies as, but it will make a very interesting picture of the little red house sitting on the moon with the Earth in the background. Any comments? WS2N.
the Nova C and the experiments that they plan on doing on the moon, they expect to find water and other gases.
Yeah, well, they're going to be searching with Nova C. So I'm not sure of the science behind it yet. I'll read about it a little bit more for next week. But, you know, yeah. You know, that's going to be the holy grail, figuring out, you know, how to get to these frozen ice. You know, and how to eventually evaporate it and create a gas out of it, you know, and condense it, creating water from that frozen ice that's, my guess, deep inside these dark craters. You know, dark craters never see light on the South Pole, and that's one of the reasons we want to go there. If we can get water or frozen ice out of the dark craters, and do what you just said, you know, you get gas out of it, eventually create from that gas gaseous hydrogen and gaseous oxygen. You know, you put the two together, you can burn it. You can use that for all kinds of energy on the moon. In the far future, you know, the theory is you could take that and use it for fuel, put it in a hydrogen, oxygen rocket system. So, you know, that would be great. So that's the main goal. I on a short term, I would say they'll use that hydrogen and oxygen for a couple of things, like fuel cells to make electricity, or oxygen to breathe, you know. More importantly, if you get that ice, you know, as a liquid, you know, something for people to drink and wash with, you know. There you go. Very good. Back to you, Charlie.
So they're looking to make the moon into a gas station and a restaurant.
Yeah, I agree. And when I see a Burger King sign up there, I'm going. I like Burger King. But yeah, I agree. You're right. I wanted to mention New Shepard. He's getting late. But New Shepard launched last week as well. And they launched 6 people. And some of them, you know, actually all of the names, I don't know, but they launched 6 people on a suborbital flight from West Texas, and it was successful. The crew eventually, the capsule separated from the rocket itself. The booster is only a one engine vehicle, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and creates roughly 150,000 pounds of thrust, a little less than that, but it's enough to get 6 people, up to 100 kilometers, which is a little, around 62 miles above the Earth. It brings them to the Kármán line. They're officially astronauts when they do that. So then the crew comes back down with 3 different parachutes. They landed safely. The booster itself, that came down vertically, and that landed like a mile away from where it took off. And that will be refurbished. This was the 10th crew vehicle that Blue Origin has launched. And around the 30th flight overall of the New Shepard vehicle. A lot of the flights were test flights at the beginning, and some of them are uncrewed flights. They put experiments on board, so a total of 30 launches. They have a couple of these New Shepard rockets that do this, as well as a couple of the capsules that and have the people in it. The next flight will be in, I think, the spring. They plan on sending 6 women next time, all women. And by the way, they always send 6 people up, except for the first flight. They just had the 2 people, you know, for the test flight. But yeah, they've been launching 6 people at a time. And this time, they will be all women. Gail King, which is a reporter, I think she's on Channel 2. Anyway, she'll be one person. Katy Perry, singer, she'll be going up. And Lauren Sanchez, that's the fiance of Jeff Bezos. So she's going to be one of the people that's going to go up as well. 3 other women, I don't know who they are yet. So that should be an interesting, that'll make the news. I should mention that the crew that will be launched to the International Space Station on the, I think it's on the 12th, we drop it. Anyway, it's a 4-person crew that will be going up on a SpaceX vehicle. And that will be, that's coming up, not this Wednesday, but the following Wednesday on the 12th. And it should be a nighttime launch from Florida, Launch Complex 39A. Around 7:45 at night. So if you're down there, you'll be able to see the crew of 4 go up on that mission. They plan on spending roughly 6 months on the International Space Station. Anne McClain will be the commander. She's been up there before. The other 3 people, I believe, have not been up there yet. Nicole Ayers, she's going to be the pilot. And then you have a mission specialist from Japan. He'll be going up there. Takaya Anashi, I think his name is. And then the Russian. They always send the Russian up. Kirill Petrov.
Kirill Petrov. Complete.
First flight up there as well. So they'll be joining the crew 7 that's presently up there, so that brings them up to 11 for about a week to 10 days. And after they're up there for a week to 10 days, crew 4 will be returning. And that one will definitely make the news because you have the 2 people that were supposed to be stranded up there, which is ridiculous. They're not stranded. They never were, and that's Tony Williams, by the way. She's a ham, KD5 PLB, as well as Butch Wilmore. They're the ones that went up on the Starliner in June of last year, June 5th they launched. And they've been up there ever since. So they'll be coming back with Nick Haig. By the way, Nick Haig is a ham, KG5 TMB. And they'll be coming down with their Russian crew member as well, Alexandria Gorbanov, I believe his name is. So those 4 will be returning. And I'm sure they'll make the news. They'll be interviewing Sonny Williams and Nick Haig and Polakowski. Any comments?
No comment.
Okay, Charlie, and then I believe tomorrow or the next day they're supposed to launch one of those Starship rockets from Boca Chica, Texas. I don't know if that's been canceled or not, and hopefully everything stays together. The last one blew up over the Turks and Caicos Island, and debris down onto that island.